dominant, though not necessarily correct, model of the early universe, inflationary cosmology. I think it's fair to say that among models of the early universe, this is the one that has made the most successful predictions. So by the normal rules of science, this guy is the leader. But on the other hand, you know, that this blackboard is made of atoms is beyond dispute. This has nowhere near the same status. Okay, that's a crucial point. Nevertheless, I just want to tell you what are the arguments that led people to regard this as the leading theory of the early universe even before the experiments came in, and what are the experiments that came in that solidified their stance? So now you can't even talk to those people. You're like, oh, inflation isn't proved, and they're like, they don't even want to talk to you. They really believe in it. Many cosmologists really believe in it now. But you should maintain a healthy skepticism. And so, in that regard, just for people who weren't here, and I mentioned this a couple of minutes ago, but so today's colloquium speaker, Paul Steinhardt, you should go to that colloquium. It's really a two-part lecture today, where the first part of the lecture, I tell you some of the arguments in favor of inflation, and then he comes along. He's actually one of the sort of co-inventors of inflation, of modern theory of inflation, but anyway, so he'll come along and tell you why all those arguments are wrong, and also various other arguments against inflation that don't even directly correspond to any of the arguments that I'll be giving. You should really go to that. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And in fact, you know, I guess right shortly after class, we'll be taking him to lunch. I don't know if you guys are all welcome to join that too. So I guess probably around 12:50 or something, we'll be going to lunch. So you can just join the table at the bistro if you want. Okay. So, what's the idea? Well, so we want to separate, you know, two things. First of all, what are the arguments for inflation that really have to do with homogeneous cosmology, that do not have to do with detailed measurements of the perturbations, the fluctuations of various physical quantities from point to point in space? Okay, these were the initial arguments, and I think it's fair to say that these are the weaker arguments. These have a kind of, you know, all of these arguments have kind of obvious holes in them. Nevertheless, the fact that there's a bunch of different arguments like this that all seem to have a common solution, you know, together they're more than the sum of their parts, but each of these arguments is kind of bad. But then, when people said, okay, well, what is the simplest model of inflation that I can write down? They realized that they could do something else. They could calculate the spectrum of primordial perturbations that it would produce. Okay, a lot of people all at once in around 1981 or 1982 realized that this same model would not only do the homogeneous things to the universe that would solve these initial problems, but it also predicts a spectrum of primordial perturbations of a particular form, at least the simplest models do. And so then that, in around the year 2000, that prediction was sort of stunningly confirmed by the WMAP satellite and a precursor balloon experiment that made the first very precise measurements of the power spectrum in the cosmic microwave background, that spectrum that we showed the other day on Friday on a slide. So the detailed peaks and troughs in that spectrum turn out to be explained very well by the predictions of inflation. But so let us start with reviewing what the homogeneous arguments are, and then in the next two lectures we'll learn how to do quantum field theory in curved space-time, and that will allow us to understand these inhomogeneous predictions. In other words, the predictions for the perturbations. Hopefully we'll get to this a little bit at the end of the lecture, but we'll have to see how fast things go. Okay, so that's one thing to differentiate between the homogeneous the homogeneous arguments and the inhomogeneous arguments, if you want. And then another important thing is just to differentiate between, you know, it's there's a question of inflation can mean two different things. There's one thing it means is that it's the hypothesis that there was a period during which the scale factor accelerated in the early universe. Okay, so that's a purely geometrical statement. It doesn't make reference to exactly what the matter was in the universe that was causing that acceleration. But that geometrical condition, that one geometrical condition, or maybe a better way that we'll reformulate it in a minute, is supposed to simultaneously solve these problems. Okay, but then, as I say, then you have to ask, well, what? Well, why? You know, according to Einstein's equations, in order to have the universe accelerate like this at early times, you have to have matter with certain properties. People began to ask themselves, what are the simplest matter Lagrangians that we can add to the action that give rise to this property at early times? Then they wrote down so they wrote down the simplest model they could think of, which is a scalar field, single scalar field phi, with the simplest potential they could think of, V of phi is equal to 1/2 m squared phi squared. Okay, really, I'm really doing violence to history here, but this is roughly speaking correct. By 1983, people had written down this model. Andre Linde had written down that model. And then, as I say, the subsequent history is that if you calculate, many other models of inflation have been ruled out now by the cosmic microwave background data. But if you calculate the predictions based on just this model, you find that at the cost of tuning one parameter, there's a free parameter you have to fix. It turns out you have to fix this parameter m to be 10 to the 13 GeV to match observations. Fix one free parameter, but then you get a lot of predictions right, quite a few predictions right. So I'll try to explain those later. So that's the bottom line. There's this important distinction between these two types of evidences for inflation, and then similarly, it's important to understand that the resolution of these problems is purely geometrical. It makes no reference to the matter content. But then the simplest matter content that we have found that achieves this makes these perturbations make successful predictions for the perturbations, very strikingly successful predictions. Let's start with these two guys. Let's see what are these homogeneous problems and why is this condition a solution to them? Did I forget a joke? I did forget a joke. Okay, so. That is my joke. Sorry. Thank you. As an aside, my student and I just finished up a paper last night, so I didn't sleep. So this whole board thing may continue in this way. So what do I want to say? We had this picture, okay, of a closed universe, and it expands, okay? And we said the co-moving observers are like you take markers and you just draw dots on the balloon, and the dots just sit there as the balloon expands. The distance between them grows. And we said that there are these two notions of distance that are common currency in cosmology. There's the physical distance and the co-moving distance. So if I say what is the co-moving distance between these two guys, it's some distance r co-moving. And then if I say what is the physical distance between them, the physical distance is a of t r of, times the co-moving distance. So the co-moving distance is just some measure. You can think of it as an angle on the sphere. It's something that stays fixed. It's defined to be a fixed quantity between two co-moving observers as the universe expands. Whereas the physical distance, in other words, the distance that if you froze the universe at some time, took out your meter stick and counted how many times you have to lay down your meter stick to get from here to here, that quantity grows in proportion to the scale factor A of t. Okay? Okay, so I mention that because, you know, it's important to distinguish in your mind between two important distance scales that characterize an expanding universe at any given moment in time, okay? So one distance scale is A of t, the radius of the three sphere, let's say, in the case of a closed universe. So this the actual size, a direct measurement of how much the universe has expanded. But then the other distance is 1 over the Hubble rate at that time. So remember, we defined the Hubble rate to be the sort of natural measure of how fast the universe is expanding at a given time. Okay, and you can see from this formula, this thing has units of 1 over t. So if we take 1 over this quantity, technically, if we take 1 over this quantity times the speed of light, but I'm going to use units where the speed of light is 1. So 1 over this quantity is a distance, another important distance in cosmology, the so-called Hubble distance. Okay, and just because h of t changes with time, the Hubble distance changes with time. So at any given moment, there's this characteristic length scale, the Hubble distance, and what we saw in an earlier lecture was that in the simple case where the scale factor of the universe expands as a simple power law in time, the Hubble distance is also basically the horizon distance that an observer in that universe sees at that moment in time. Okay, so at this moment in time, if the universe had always been matter dominated and would continue to be matter dominated, so it always expanded as t to the 2/3. Okay, then that's a decelerating power law expanding universe. So if in that universe I look out a distance 1 over h, at this moment in time, the observers that are that distance from me are the furthest observers who have ever been able to send a signal to me since the Big Bang. Okay, or alternatively, if the universe was accelerating for all time, if the universe was dominated by vacuum energy and was accelerating, or anyway, if the universe was expanding as t to the p with p greater than 1, so it's accelerating, then again, I look out a distance h, and that is the distance to the furthest observer to whom I will ever be able to communicate between now and the end of the t equals infinity, the end of the universe. Okay, so there are these two important distances, A and the Hubble radius. Let's take their ratio. Okay, let's consider their ratio. So I'll divide the Hubble radius by A. Okay, but in other words, if I take a distance and divide it by A, that's converting this physical distance to a co-moving distance. So this thing is called the co-moving Hubble radius. Okay, it's the physical Hubble radius at any given moment, converted to co-moving coordinates. Okay? So, now I want to say the following. The geometrical statement of inflation, we went to all this trouble to define the co-moving Hubble radius because the geometrical thing that inflation is supposed to satisfy in order to solve the homogeneous problems that I'll describe in a moment is most simply stated in this language. So, around you at any given moment, you have a co-moving Hubble radius. Okay, it's some sphere around you. Here's you. I mean, so that's you. And I mean, not. It's clear who I'm pointing at. Yeah, just you, really. So you have some sphere around you, and so what happens is that, as we'll see in a minute, when the universe decelerates, like it used to be that before the invention of inflation, we thought that the universe was always decelerating from the Big Bang up until the present. When the universe is decelerating, co-moving Hubble radius around you, 1 over ah, is monotonically growing with time. Okay? So initially you had some tiny little sphere, which just included your stomach, but then that was 1 second after the Big Bang. You weren't hungry yet, so it was no, it was fine. That wasn't. I wasn't raised right. That's why I feel compelled to constantly insert these things. So in a purely decelerating universe, there was initially a tiny sphere surrounding each observer. It grew to a gigantic size. So it's some gigantic sphere today. Okay, but in a decelerating universe, but in an accelerating universe, sorry, in an accelerating universe, the opposite behavior holds. The co-moving Hubble radius around you shrinks with time, and the statement of inflation, the geometrical statement, is just the following, that inflation purports to solve problems that we'll discuss in a moment, provided that prior to the standard Big Bang epoch during which this sphere has been expanding, there was a preceding epoch where the sphere was contracting, and the contraction was supposed to be, the amount that it contracted initially is supposed to be greater than the amount that it subsequently expanded. Okay, so the picture is, inflation wants the universe to be like this. At some early time, you were surrounded by a co-moving Hubble sphere that was bigger than the co-moving Hubble sphere today. Then the universe accelerated, scrunched it down to a tiny co-moving Hubble sphere. Then the ordinary radiation-dominated epoch began. The universe began its normal Big Bang decelerated expansion. Ever since, the sphere has been increasing, but it hasn't yet grown as big as it once was. Okay, so that's kind of the geometrical picture you should keep in your mind. And so let's see why. What are the puzzles, and why is that supposed to alleviate?
So what is the physical meaning of the co-moving Hubble radius?
What is the physical meaning? That is a tricky question. I'm going to explain in a moment why it's related to these three puzzles. But you know, the way, if you wanted to say, the way I explained it at the beginning was as follows, that in a simple universe, a universe that has been power law expanding forever, 1 over h, the Hubble radius, is the actual distance to your horizon. Could be your past horizon or your future horizon, depending on whether you're an accelerating or decelerating universe. But it represents sort of the largest sphere that you can see or communicate with. And the co-moving Hubble radius is co-moving. It's just the radius of that sphere is co-moving coordinates. That's the way I've explained it so far. But we're actually going to see, if you want these puzzles, we'll give you other interpretations. I can just say one right now. So if A over H, or just to add to what I just said. If A over H is tiny, so here you are again. You're part of the universe. You're really just basking in the glow of the cosmic microwave background here. If 1 over H is tiny relative to A, so if the co-moving Hubble radius is very small, then that's saying that the Hubble radius that surrounds you is very, very small relative to the size of the sphere, okay, relative to the radius of the sphere A. So this is the distance H, and the radius of the sphere is A. So in the regime where this guy is nearly
zero, that means that the sort of characteristic cosmological scale that surrounds you at a given moment in time is so small that you think you live on a little flat portion of the universe. So this is the situation with us today, that 1 over h today is about the distance from us to the cosmic microwave background. It's about to the sphere around us that releases the cosmic microwave background. Beyond that is opaque to us. We can't see any further than that with light. So that's sort of the size of the sphere that we can see today. So the cosmic microwave background photons were released from some sphere around us like this, of size h, 1 over h. The fact that we observe the universe to be nearly flat today, the fact that when we go out and measure the density of the universe, it's nearly exactly the critical density, and measure in various ways, and instead of being closed or open, the universe is spatially flat today. In this language, that is saying that the size of the universe that we see after this surface that is the cosmic microwave background surface, or in practice, the radius 1 over h, they're almost the same thing. If the universe really is a three sphere, it's saying that the sphere that we see is tiny relative to the three sphere we live on. So we only see a little flat. You know, what we see looks like a little three dimensional Euclidean space. Just like an observer can only probe the local neighborhood of your. Let's see that as follows. That's the first thing that I was going to say is the flatness puzzle. This is one we met earlier in class. Did you see the puzzle again? To just remind you. If we start with our two equations, our two dynamical equations, the Friedman equation and the continuity equation, so let's just first rewrite these a little bit to make them more directly applicable. Let's divide both sides by h squared. Okay, so this guy becomes 1 is equal to rho over the critical density. Remember, the critical density is 3h squared divided by 8 pi g. It's the density that is the threshold between closed and open, minus k over this co-moving Hubble radius, or k times the co-moving Hubble radius squared. And instead of this equation, for the moment, let's imagine you took the time derivative of both sides here, and then you took the time derivative and you get 2h dot equals 8 pi g over 3 rho dot minus, and that's some time derivative of this guy. Anyway, you use this rho dot equation to remove the rho dot, simplify, you'll find that the equation you get is the so-called acceleration equation. Okay, so these two equations are equivalent to these two equations, but for the moment, these are a little bit easier to use. So first of all, what does this equation say? This equation says, well, there is a threshold relationship between p and rho. So if p is greater than minus 1/3 rho, this quantity is positive, and because there's a minus sign here, the acceleration is negative. Okay, so if p is greater than minus 1/3 rho, that implies that p dt of a dot, in other words, d a double dot, is positive. But a dot here is nothing but a times h. I mean, h is a dot over a, so a times h is just a dot. This is p is less than minus 1/3, the universe is accelerating. The universe is decelerating. In other words, 1 over the Hubble radius, 1 over the co-moving radius is shrinking. Why am I making this so confusing? So here's what I'm trying to say. If a double dot is less than 0, that's equivalent to saying that 1 over the co-moving Hubble radius is shrinking. So in other words, the co-moving Hubble radius is growing. That's what you're saying. So in a decelerating universe, a double dot less than 0 implies the co-moving Hubble radius is growing, and the other case is the other way. Okay. 1/3 grow implies a double dot greater than 0, so the universe is accelerating. That implies that the co-moving Hubble radius is shrinking. Okay, and then in that situation, well, so in the limit that 1 over ah, in the limit that the co-moving Hubble radius goes to 0, this constraint says this term becomes negligible, and rho over rho critical is equal to 1. So in the limit, when you accelerate, you drive this term to 0, and so you drive rho to rho critical. Or alternatively, when you decelerate, this term gets bigger and bigger, and this constraint drives rho away from rho critical. Okay, so the flattness puzzle is that today we observe that rho over rho critical is equal to 1 plus or minus 0.01. Okay, so it's equal to rho critical within 1%. And to take our picture of the observer with the with the sphere around them, what this is saying is that as the sphere grew, rho got further and further away from rho critical. And so y, even though it's grown by many, many, many orders of magnitude, is it still so close to rho critical? In particular, if you plug in numbers and you say, okay, even when the sphere is the huge co-moving sphere we observe around us today, and the critical density is 1 to within 1%, then if you look back at the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, when the radius of this sphere was smaller by many orders of magnitude, then the rho had to be equal to the critical density to 1 plus or minus part in 10 to the 31. And if you went back even further to earlier events, it would have to be even more precisely tuned to the critical density. So the flattness puzzle is why, in the early universe, was rho so precisely tuned to the critical density? And the explanation of inflation is just, well, inflation says, well, no problem, you know. Okay, so the flattness puzzle got worse and worse and worse as the universe has expanded during the decelerating phase. But, you know, if I just took a previous accelerating phase and undid all of that expansion, then, you know, the universe could have had, rho could have been 10 times rho critical at early times. But then as long as the universe contracted by a factor of 10 to the 3 more than it subsequently expanded, then that would account for the fact that it's within 1% of the critical density today. Okay? Yeah.
So when we're measuring the flattness of the universe, we're not actually measuring k, but we're measuring k over the Hubble radius squared, co-moving Hubble. So when you say that experimentally the universe seems to be flat,
yes.
Maybe I thought we're saying k is close to 0, but that's not what we're saying. We're saying that that's an option, or the denominator is just really huge.
So I explained in an earlier lecture that by convention, so k is plus or minus 1 or 0. Think of k as a discrete constant that tells you which of the three solutions you're looking at.
Right.
And furthermore, we've rescaled coordinates when k is plus or minus 1. We said that without loss of generality, you can rescale coordinates to set rho, bottom line is you can rescale coordinates so that literally a of t is literally the radius of the three sphere, or the curvature radius of the hyperbola, in the case of plus 1 and minus 1 cases.
But so we cannot really measure k experimentally. We can only measure the ratio.
The way you would you can measure it in two different ways. One is if you go out and measure the total energy density in the universe and find that it is greater than the critical density, then either Einstein's equations are wrong or K is plus one. Or if you know, there are other ways, more geometrical ways you can also measure it. And that's what the cosmic microwave background lets you do. So that's if you know that if you're here and you know that a distance, some known distance away from you, there is a ruler on the sky of a fixed length. Let's say you know the length. Turns out in the CMB, is like this. There's a size scale that we know what it is in the CMB. And you can ask, if the universe was flat, and this thing was a known distance d away from you and had a known length l, you would know what angle it should subtend on the sky. It should subtend some angle like delta theta is equal to l over d. But if the universe is positively curved, then just like on a sphere, geodesics converge. So on a sphere, if these things now send light rays to you, they'll be like, the ones that reach you will be the ones that look like this. So you'll see, it'll look to you, the universe will distort this ruler, so it looks to you like it's a larger angle than it would in the flat case, or if it's negatively curved, the opposite thing looks like it's a smaller angle. So there are ways that you can measure whether the universe is positively or negatively curved. I'm just saying that by convention, K is, without loss of generality, the number K can be, this expression is just constant, can be taken to plus one. So the thing, I don't know.
So what do these measurements give us? What K do they give us? Positive, negative?
So all measurements that we do are consistent with K being, are consistent with K being equal to zero, by which I really mean that they're consistent with rho being equal to rho critical to plus or minus 1%. That is to say, if K is different than zero, this term is so small on the Euclidean equation. That is to say, one way to say it is that this term is so small in the Euclidean equation that we haven't been able to detect its presence dynamically. Another way to say it is that we are looking at such a small patch of the curve of the hypothetically curved universe that we have not been able to detect its curvature. We only see this local patch, which is part of the global splat.
So even in those measurements, things like K over A enter instead of K on its own.
I mean, I guess that's what you're saying. Yeah, physically, that's right. So somehow, in some sense, physically, you might think K equals plus or minus one or zero, that if you changed it, there would be some drastic response in some experiment because those things are not infinitesimally close to each other. But that's not how it goes. In practice, I guess that's what you mean, that if K over AH is sufficiently small, then that's exactly the situation. You can't tell the difference between K equals plus or minus zero. So puzzle number two is the horizon puzzle, which we also met. Yeah.
So we've been measuring our small fraction of the manifold and that looks flat. Then is the reason why you draw a sphere with our small patch on it instead of drawing a saddle with our small patch on it? Just because of an assumption that the FRW metric is natural, and so assumptions of homogeneity and isotropy.
Why have I been drawing a sphere instead of a saddle? Because I am bad at it. We don't know whether the universe is a sphere or a saddle. Both of those are FRW or possible FRW metrics. I'm good at this. I mean, you've probably been to other lectures, but not everybody can do a sphere as well as I can. Okay. So the horizon problem. So we met the horizon problem as well. We said that, so again, before the invention of inflation, the universe was thought to have been decelerating. You know, what we observed in the universe as of circa 1980 was matter and radiation, both of which lead to decelerated expansion. And we saw in an earlier lecture that if you live in a decelerating universe, you're surrounded by a past horizon. If you're in an accelerating universe, though, you're not. You're only surrounded by a future horizon. So we thought we lived in a decelerating universe. So around us, we look along our past light cone, which tells us sort of how far away, how far away can someone have sent a signal to us. You know, it only included some finite patch of the universe, and there were other co-moving observers out here who never would have made contact with us, never could have made contact with us out here, so that's not a problem. Problem is that we see from a surface right after this, we see the cosmic microwave background photons. The cosmic microwave background photons were emitted along this cone to us from some slice through the cone that is just above the Big Bang, if the universe was really always decelerating. And so, you know, we get a photon from this direction, and then we also get another photon that climbs up the front side of the cone. That's supposed to be the back side. There. One photon gets to us along the back side, one photon gets to us along the front side. But then each of them also has a light cone to their past. And they're just totally far away from each other. The question is, why then does the CMB have exactly the same properties over here as it does over here? If you see two things that have exactly the same properties, classically speaking, and again, I agree that there is basically a gaping hole in this argument, that you naturally think that if they look the same, they had to coordinate with one another to look the same. Or at least we don't have an explanation for why in this model for why these guys should look the same. Maybe you would come up with some new theory of cosmological initial conditions that would predict that just everywhere along our past lifetime the initial conditions were the same. But we don't have a theory like that. So there was no explanation. So what inflation does is it says, okay, there was really at some point prior to the CMB surface, this cone fails. Instead, past here, the universe was accelerating. At that point, the past horizon extends out to infinity. If I extend it far enough back, it will include all of the space time. There's no past horizon in an accelerating universe. So this problem just goes away. And if you actually work it through in detail, the amount of acceleration you need. The amount of acceleration that you need to undo this separation is again it's exactly the same thing. It's the same geometrical fact that as long as the amount of acceleration shrunk our co-moving bubble sphere more than the subsequent deceleration expanded it, these Hubble patches come into contact and have plenty of time to come into thermal contact. Maybe I haven't decided yet exactly what to do in tomorrow's tutorial, but possibly checking. Well, so I don't know yet. Maybe we'll check that on tomorrow's tutorial, or maybe we'll do something about it. But Tinker. So the final thing. Is the so-called magnetic monopole problem. So the idea here was that in the mid-70s, people invented the first grand unified theories that took the gauge group of the standard model and reinterpreted it as part of a bigger unified gauge group might be, anyway, some bigger, more symmetric theory, where it was all just one symmetry group. And these theories had several properties that were so beautiful that everyone was convinced they were right. And most people still are convinced that they must be on the right track in some sense. But back in the 70s, people were like, sure. I mean, then in the 80s, so these things made some predictions. They predicted the proton should decay. People looked for that, and that didn't happen. So that took some of the wind out of grand unified theories. Although people found ways to get around that, push proton decay just past what experiments would see. In any case, in the 70s, people thought grand unified theories were definitely correct, and they thought the universe had always been decelerating, that the universe had been had basically been expanding, and T had just been radiation dominated all the way since the Big Bang. So T had just basically dropped. T and rho had both. At some point, the universe had effectively zero, had nearly zero size, and T and rho were infinity, and then they just cooled through astronomically high energy scales. And got colder and colder until they got down to less exotic energy scales. But as they cooled, the idea was that three orders of magnitude, you can predict at what is the characteristic energy scale, just like the characteristic energy scale of the electroweak symmetry breaking phase transition in the standard model, we know is 1 TeV, so 10 to the 3 GeV, that's the standard model. So in grand unified theories, you can calculate what the energy scale is. It's 10 to the 16 GeV, much higher, but still below the Planck scale. It's still a factor of 1,000 below the Planck scale. So the idea is that we're well below the Planck scale, so quantum gravity is probably at least naively not important. So our basic description in general relativity seems legit. And the universe is cooling, and eventually it passes through this temperature scale. At temperatures below, temperatures above this scale, just like in the standard model, it turns out using thermal QFT, you can predict that even if this theory has a symmetry breaking potential, like the Higgs potential in the standard model, these grand unified theories have scalar fields with a symmetry breaking potential. So the field wants to lie in some particular symmetry breaking direction rather than sit at the symmetric point in its potential. But when you add temperature corrections, there's a term that goes proportional to phi squared T squared. At sufficiently high temperatures, that'll take any potential and fold it up so that the minimum potential is at the symmetric point. So as the universe cools, initially temperature is so high that the field is in its unbroken phase, in its symmetric phase, and then cools, and eventually the field is favored to lie in its symmetry broken phase, but what you see from this picture, so we have our observer, make our observer grow smaller. So again, in the decelerating universe, the co-moving horizon around each observer is growing. So if this is our current co-moving horizon, the co-moving horizon around each observer at the very early time of this grand unified phase transition was much tinier. And so the universe was filled with these tiny little patches. If you look at the current sphere that we see, okay, the current sphere is something like this. But if you ask how many of these gut scale spheres fit inside there, there's tons of them. And so what is the problem with that? Well, in a purely decelerating universe, in a radiation dominated universe, these spheres really represent the causal horizon, the past horizon around each of these observers at the time that the grand unified symmetry breaking phase transition took place. And so the fields over here once it was favored for them to break symmetry, they would do it in some direction, but field in a neighboring patch, they had no way to communicate with these guys to know to break in the same direction, so they would break in some different direction. Okay, every different patch breaks in a different direction. So the overall effect of that is that what can happen in these theories is that the fields can wind around basically the Higgs potential. They can just by randomly breaking in different directions, there can be regions that have tied themselves into a knot that is stable, that cannot be undone. And these things are in grand unified theories, this is inevitable, and these things carry magnetic charge. They're called magnetic monopoles. That's not the important thing. The important thing is that they're heavy. Each of these particles that gets formed, each of these stable knots in the field configuration, has a mass about equal to 10 to the 16 GeV, so astronomically high by a particle physics standpoint, particle physics standards. And then you get roughly one of these every few Hubble volumes at that time. So you get, maybe you need 10 Hubble volumes to have the field wind around enough to get a knot. But it's a random process. But roughly speaking, every order one number of gut Hubble volumes, you get a magnetic monopole. So you get tons of super heavy particles inside our currently observable patch of the universe. So if you just add up what is the total energy density from all of these magnetic monopoles, it's much more than the critical density. Okay, so it would just be completely in conflict with observations. So again, how does inflation want to come to the rescue? Well, inflation wants to say, okay, we're not going to throw out one possible thing you could say is, well, the universe really was radiation dominated all the way back, but grand unified theories are wrong. So that's not what people said. Instead, they said grand unified theories are right. The universe cooled, symmetry breaking happened, monopoles were formed. One monopole formed per Hubble volume at that time. Per Hubble volume at the gut phase transition, but the only thing that's wrong with this picture is that the Hubble volume at the gut time was not this size, it was this size. So one Hubble, so maybe one monopole formed in this whole volume, and then it's just that there was a subsequent period of inflation which shrunk the Hubble radius down to here before it began to subsequently expand. And so you're just misinterpreting, you're just misreading the history of the universe when you think that this was the causally connected size at the time of grand unified phase transition symmetry breaking. You're just neglecting the fact that actually you're just getting the history of the universe wrong. It's not that the phase transition took place and then it was radiation dominated ever since. It's that the phase transition took place, you got one monopole in this whole volume, but then instead of being followed by radiation dominated, and it was followed by a long period of inflation, then followed by radiation dominated. So the point is, this geometrical condition we gave before, the one we keep repeating, that the universe shrunk more than it subsequently expanded, that the co-moving Hubble sphere shrunk more than it subsequently expanded, that's enough to guarantee that instead of having tons of these monopoles in our present-day Hubble volume, we'll have less than one in our whole present-day Hubble volume, which would explain why we've never seen magnetic monopoles. Okay, so those are the three homogeneous puzzles I wanted to tell you about. Are any questions about those? Those will all be hastily decimated by Paul later in his talk. So now I just wanted to get us ready to do quantum filtering curve space time. Let's just talk about, so suppose you found these arguments very compelling, which taken together, people did. each of these arguments, well, you can judge for yourself. I mean, you can judge for yourself. It is a historical fact that all three of these arguments coming at once made believers out of most early universe cosmologists. That the theorists believed in this. That's the bottom line. The theory types believe. Okay, so then the next question they ask themselves is, well, you know, so now we want some matter component. We want to understand what can we actually add to the Lagrangian of nature without modifying general relativity to achieve this behavior. Is there some simple matter component we can add to the universe that will have this property, that it will automatically make the universe accelerate at early times and then switch over to decelerated expansion? So the next thing I just want to show is that if you just take the ordinary Lagrangian of nature and then add a single scalar field with a potential with appropriate properties, and in particular, the real gold standard to keep in mind is just the simplest potential, 1/2 m² / 5², that'll do the job. Okay, so what am I assuming about this potential? I am assuming that the potential has the following property, that it has a minimum. So here I'm plotting v of phi as a function of phi. I'm assuming that it has a minimum at v equals 0, minimum with negligible potential energy. But that it was initially in the early universe, through some unknown mechanism, it was initially displaced sufficiently far from the minimum, and that subsequently, okay, so the idea is that subsequently the field just rolls down, the potential just applies a force to the field that rolls it down to the minimum. But if the potential has the appropriate properties, which I will describe right now, that just in the process of rolling down like this, first the field will roll slowly, like it's sort of oozing through molasses. It'll be very overdamped, and the universe will accelerate. And then, when it gets sufficiently close to the minimum, it will become underdamped, and will just begin to oscillate like this, and the universe will automatically begin to decelerate. Okay, as the requisite behavior. So let's just see, for the case of 1/2 m² / 5², why that's true. So as I think you guys already did in the tutorial on Tuesday, just to briefly recap, if you just calculate the team mu here and compare it to the expression for a perfect fluid stress energy tensor, you find expressions for rho and p for a homogeneous scalar field. So for rho, we find 1/2 π/2² + v of 5. For p, we find 1/2 π/2² - v of 5. And then if we just plug these two expressions into the continuity equation, rho dot is equal to -3h ρ + p, we get an equation of motion for phi, which is just phi double dot plus 3h phi plus m² phi is equal to 0. So as we already explained in class the other day, what happens in this model qualitatively? So imagine you initially displace the field sufficiently far from the origin. Well, if you displace it sufficiently far, its energy density is huge. By the Friedman equation, h² goes like the energy density. If you make the energy density huge, you make h huge. So initially, if the field is sufficiently displaced, this friction term, this friction term in the equation of motion. So this is like a Dan-Fermat oscillator, the acceleration term, the forcing term. So this would just be a simple harmonic oscillator. Now we've added this friction term, this damping term, is proportional to the velocity, force proportional to velocity. So at early times, H is so big that this term dominates over this term. So if we completely neglect this term, we found that the solution of this equation was that phi is a constant term plus another constant term that goes plus another constant term times 1 over a cubed. So this term, as a grows, damps away to 0. We're left with this term. So if we completely ignored this term, phi would just grind to a halt at some point on the potential. Now, in practice, this term is not actually 0. And so what happens when we actually take this guy into account? Well, you know, it's like when you drop a ball and it reaches its terminal velocity. There's a balance that's achieved between the friction term and the forcing term, between gravity pulling you down and friction slowing your motion. Okay, so that's what happens here. This is the so-called slow roll phase, basically the phase where the field hits its terminal velocity and gradually oozes down at its terminal velocity. We can estimate the terminal velocity by just setting those two terms, you know, equal to 0. So if we just solve that, we get phi dot the velocity of the field is equal to minus m squared phi over 3h. So that's the famous slow roll formula for the velocity of the inflaton field during the quote unquote slow roll phase, this overdamped phase. More generally, if we just kept the potential v of phi here instead of taking a specific dimension m squared phi squared, this guy would be, this term would be v prime of phi. And this expression would have v minus v prime of phi in the numerator. In any case, so that's the, so the field slowly oozes down. As it slowly oozes down, h drops and drops and drops until eventually h drops below critical damping. So this becomes an underdamped oscillator. This term eventually becomes negligible relative to this one. And then we're in the regime where, well, if we really ignored this term, the field would just oscillate with frequency m at a constant amplitude. But as you showed in the tutorial, I hope, this one, if you actually take into account the presence of this term, that its effect is to a first approximation, the field does just oscillate with frequency m. The effect of the expansion of the universe is to cause that oscillation to decay proportional to 1 over 8 to 3 halves. And if you just plug this into the expression for rho and p, you find that in this regime, in the limit where if you just take this formula and assume that m is much bigger than h, in other words, in the underdamped regime, you find that w is approximately 0. In other words, w, remember, is the equation of state parameter, the ratio of p to rho. That's just the qualitative way to see. I should have said. So at early times, the field slow rolls at its terminal velocity, quote unquote slow rolls, meaning it oozes, it's overdamped, it oozes with its terminal velocity. At late times, it's an underdamped oscillator whose amplitude gradually decreases. If you take both of these solutions under the assumption that m is much bigger than h in this case, or much smaller than h in this case, and you plug in to these expressions for rho and p, you find that in the slow roll phase, in the overdamped phase, that p is approximately equal to minus rho. And in the underdamped phase, the later phase, p is equal to approximately 0 times rho. P is negligible relative to rho. So this is the w equals minus 1 phase. This is a w equals 0 phase. W equals minus 1 in the Friedman equation leads to accelerated expansion. That's the thing we solved on an earlier lecture and a thing you checked in an earlier tutorial. So basically, W is equal to minus 1/3 is the transition. When you have an equation of state that's W that's bigger than minus 1/3, the universe decelerates. Equation of state that's less than minus 1/3, universe accelerants. So this says that this simple scalar potential has the property, when you couple it to GR, that if you just displace the field initially far enough away from the origin of its potential, initially the universe automatically accelerates, later the universe automatically decelerates. That's basically the homogeneous story of inflation. Now that the two additional bits we have to add are that at the end of the day, well, all of the energy density of the universe doesn't stay trapped in the scalar field forever. At some point it had better decay. These particles of phi boson had better decay into the particles of the standard model, so that the normal universe that we see around us can proceed. But then, in addition, the point that we are going to try to explain in the coming two lectures is that automatically, even if you try to set this field, even if you try to make it perfectly homogeneous, like we just described, you try to displace it from the origin, but just make a homogeneous scalar field that's the same at every point in space and let it roll down, you know, the zero-point fluctuations of quantum mechanics forbid you from doing that. So even if you put the fluctuations of this field in their vacuum state, you make them as small as possible, they're there. And then we want to show that the subsequent evolution of the universe in the scalar field, as it rolls down, automatically amplify those fluctuations, give them a particular power spectrum, we'll describe. And the idea is that that power spectrum of fluctuations in the field correspond to power spectrum of fluctuations in the density, if you want, or in the curvature from point to point in space, that exactly match the spectrum of perturbations that we observe in measurements of the cosmic microwave background. Okay? So